Great to have you with us here on the Ideas Network. Larry Mueller here. Thanks for joining us today. We're going to be taking a look at legal issues on the show today and zeroing in a bit on bankruptcy. Filing for bankruptcy, it can have some long-lasting effects, and we'll look at maybe who should file, what happens when you do, with our guest today, two attorneys with the Axley Law Firm in Madison, both partners. Mike Riley's been with us on the show a lot of times over the years. He represents clients in insurance coverage issues, mediation, and arbitration. Mike Riley, good to see you.
Good to see you, Larry.
And Kevin Trost is, well, first-time visitor with us. He's an attorney specializing in creditors' rights, workouts, receiverships, residential, commercial foreclosures, commercial litigation. Kevin Trost, welcome.
Thanks, Larry. It's a pleasure to be on your show.
So, as you listen into these two experts, I hope you'll join in with your own questions or comments as we move along. What would you like to know about bankruptcy? What legal questions do you have? What other legal questions might you have? You can join in the conversation. The number to call is 1-800-642-1234, or shoot us an email to ideas@wpr.org. And just remember, talks like this, and certainly the one today, is intended as general information, should not be relied upon specifically or construed as legal advice. That's a good thing to say, isn't it, Mike?
It's helpful. You know, if we can, before we get to Kevin, who knows a lot about that, and I know nothing about that topic, so let me just chime in with a quick one on the topic I do know a fair amount about, and that's auto insurance, and maybe just insurance generally. You know, it's brought home to me constantly how important it is to have adequate coverage. And we've talked about it before. Certainly, you want adequate liability coverage. You know, you should have at least $100,000, and you should look at an umbrella policy because they're really quite inexpensive relative to everything else. But a couple things that I think people tend to overlook. One is medical payments coverage. You can opt out of that. People do. People often end up with $1,000, and $1,000 won't, it'll just about cover your ambulance bill, you know, if you have to be taken somewhere. It won't begin to cover your emergency room bill, which can certainly be $20,000, $25,000 if, you know, you have significant injuries and they do a bunch of studies. But having at least $10,000 to me is really critical. I mean, that's a minimum amount, and it isn't all that much more expensive than buying $1,000. The second one, and again, we've talked about it, but underinsured motorist coverage. And I know this all starts sounding like, what in heaven's name is that? Uninsured motorist coverage takes care of you if somebody hits you and they don't have insurance. And even though we're a mandatory insurance state, there's still a lot of people out there that don't have insurance. But underinsured is really critical because that takes care of you if people have, for instance, a minimum 2550 policy, which is all too common in this state. And if you get injured and you have an injury that's worth a lot more than that, people who carry that kind of coverage very seldom have assets that you're going to be able to go after. So you need to protect yourself, and you do that by buying underinsured motorist coverage. And you should make sure that that's at least 100 and probably should be more than that. It should never be less than your liability limits. And some companies, and I see this pretty regularly, will write higher liability limits and lower underinsured limits. They'll have a $250,000 per person liability limit and only $100,000 underinsured, which means essentially you're protecting everybody else a lot more fully than you're protecting yourself and your own family and people who might be in the car with you. And finally, it's important that people understand when you buy that coverage, you never really get what you think you're buying, because underinsured motorist coverage, in every case, the companies will have a provision that says we get to subtract whatever you got paid by anyone else. So even though you may think you have 100, the most you're ever going to have is 75. And if the other side has 100 and you have 100, they're not going to pay you anything. It's going to wipe out your underinsured. So that I think, is a point that everyone should look at their policy, make sure you've got enough of those coverages.
You know, and it's a good thing to bring up, because just turning to Kevin, this is the kind of thing that can lead to bankruptcy if you're underinsured or not insured. I know, just thinking about some of the homes that have been lost here in recent weeks due to the flooding, there were homes that are essentially done, and the people didn't have flood insurance, of course. And so, you know, you could be looking at owing $200,000 and having nothing really to show for it.
Yeah, that's very true. If you end up having a large debt or a large series of debts that you have no way that you're going to be able to pay, that's when you start looking at bankruptcy.
Is that a typical, why should somebody file for bankruptcy?
Well, I think you have to, before you consider filing bankruptcy, I think you have to step back and look at the kinds of debts that you've accumulated over the years, because certain debts are going to be more favorably discharged in bankruptcy than others, because there are certain kinds of debts that can't be discharged in bankruptcy. For example, if you have a lot of back taxes that you owe the state or the federal government,
you got to pay those anyway.
Those aren't going away, no matter what kind of bankruptcy you file. However, if this is a very common situation where you have somebody that's accumulated a very large amount of medical debt, you know, that's debt that, if it's accumulated and it's a lot, and it's not something that somebody's going to be able to reasonably pay off over a period of time, and the hospital or medical provider isn't going to work with you to make some kind of deal or special arrangement, then I think that's the kind of situation where you most likely see somebody turn to a bankruptcy attorney and start looking into bankruptcy, because that can be most advantageous for them.
Are the laws pretty much the same, or are they different from one state to the next? I mean, are our laws about like what you find in Minnesota, for example?
For the most part, you know, bankruptcy is federally regulated under the United States Code. And so for the most part, you know, if you file bankruptcy in Wisconsin, whereas if you file bankruptcy in another state, it's going to be largely the same. There are some state-specific provisions that come into play, especially with regards to the amount of money that you get for certain exemptions. And by exemptions, I mean when you file for bankruptcy, the bankruptcy code provides that you get to keep a certain dollar value worth of stuff in different categories. And those are called exemptions.
Yeah. And I can remember, now this goes back some years, but there was a political figure in Washington, D.C., that lived in the Northeast and moved to Florida before filing bankruptcy, because I think it had to do something with he was able to retain his house and everything.
Now, I can remember reading stories about, you know, I think it may be Texas, Kevin. I don't know where it was, but they basically protect the homestead. And, you know, if it happens to be a, you know, a 5,000-acre ranch, you know, with a mansion on it, I think you can still protect the homestead. But I don't think we get that break here in Wisconsin.
No, I don't think the laws here are quite that generous.
So there's a little difference. What's required before you file for bankruptcy? What do you need to do?
I think the first decision somebody needs to make is whether they want to file themselves or whether they want to hire an attorney to assist them in filing. And there can be a lot of ins and outs in the bankruptcy code and a lot of reasons why you should file or reasons why you may not want to file. And I think for that reason alone, I think it's worth at least consulting with somebody who, you know, has an expertise in the bankruptcy field to kind of make a determination of whether it's even worth filing. Because really, bankruptcy kind of is, if you have a lot of debt, that can be kind of more of a final step or final solution or, you know, solution of last resort. A lot of times there are solutions that can be come up with, that can be arrived at in talking with your creditors and people that you owe money to, that stops short of actually having to file for bankruptcy. And I think you probably need to explore those options and make sure those options are completely off the table before
taking that last step.
Exactly. Because that can be a pretty harsh last step, because there are certain consequences to filing for bankruptcy. Yeah. Advantages too, but also consequences.
What are the major consequences?
Well, I think the major, if you're looking at disadvantages, you know, reasons why you might not want to file, is filing a bankruptcy is going to have a significant effect on your credit rating for quite a number of years. And the number of years that it's going to affect you depends on the type of bankruptcy you file. I mean, the two most common kinds of individual bankruptcies are Chapter 7 and Chapter 13. And a Chapter 7 bankruptcy is going to stay on your credit report for upwards of 10 years, whereas a Chapter 13, which is a little less harsh, will stay on for about 7 years.
Yeah. And so what's the difference between one is less of an issue than the other, or what?
Well, a Chapter 7 bankruptcy is called a liquidation, technically, where after you take and put your exemptions in place to protect certain items of property, certain amounts of money that you have, whatever's left over, the bankruptcy trustee takes and divvies up amongst your various creditors and the people that you owe money to. And after that's done, you get a discharge, which means those people can no longer come after you for those existing debts any longer. However, you know, you have that stain on your credit report going on for a number of years.
Yeah.
Kevin, do you have to continue making payments in a 13, or is it usually just they take what you have that's not exempt and you're done?
Well, that's the difference between a 7 and a 13. A 7 is one where it's a one-time liquidation.
Yeah.
And cut, dried, the money, you know, each creditor gets a small share of, you know, what it has coming to it, and you're done. The opposite is a Chapter 13. And that's where you get a plan approved with the bankruptcy court to repay a certain amount of your debt to various creditors. And the bankruptcy court officially approves a plan for payment that's overseen by a bankruptcy court trustee. And that goes on for a number of years, generally 5, where you pay money on a regular basis, usually monthly, to the bankruptcy court trustee. And then the trustee takes the money that you've paid in and sends out the checks to your creditors.
I see. That's how that works. Well, lots of callers online with questions. You can join in at 800-642-1234 or email us at ideas@wpr.org. I'm Larry Mueller. Dave Potratz, our producer. Jill Nadeau. Dave Potratz is our engineer. Jill Nadeau is our producer. Our guests today, Mike Riley and Kevin Trost, attorneys with the Axley Law Firm of Madison. We're here on the Ideas Network, talking a bit about bankruptcy today and some other legal issues as well. Certainly insurance and other things we can talk about with our two guests, Mike Riley and Kevin Trost from the Axley Law Firm of Madison. Larry Mueller here. Thanks so much for joining us. Lots of callers online. Every line is filled with questions of one sort or another. And David in South Milwaukee has been waiting a while, so let's go there and find out what's on David's mind. David, hi. Thanks for calling.
Hey, thanks for the program and thanks for your service. I'm calling in regards to an auto accident. A couple of years ago, I had an auto accident, and I was sideswiped, and I had some knee pain, and I thought, well, I don't want to run to the doctor, and sure enough, the knee pain went away over time. So I was involved in another accident in early February, and I had back pain, and I informed the person who hits me, insurance company, and they had coverage for $5,000 and up to a year. So I initially went for an exam and found about the back pain, but then I had some car issues and couldn't follow up on it, and sure enough, it seemed to go away, but and I was taking it easy as far as exercise and things like that. And now 6 months later, I tried to do a jog, and sure enough, the pain came right back. So I called the insurance company and said, hey, I need to resume treatment for this. And they were very hesitant about it. They were saying, well, we can't pre-authorize this, and they were kind of backing off. So I'm wondering where I stand now.
Okay.
Sure. The first thing that you need to know is it's a 3-year statute of limitations, and statute of limitations just say you got to do something within a set period of time or you lose your rights. And so with a personal injury claim, it's 3 years from the date of injury. So you want to be sure that by that time you've either worked something out with the company and settled, or you've started a lawsuit, because that once you start the lawsuit, that tolls the statute. The statute stops running. You've done what you needed to do. First of all, you know, you said the other guy's car said that the other insurer said that they had $5,000 a year. What they probably said is, we're willing to pay up to $5,000 in bills over the next year. And that's a pretty standard ploy by insurance companies. They often will offer you a certain amount of money. And I don't know if they did that, where they'll say, OK, we'll give you $1,500 or $2,000. They get away as cheap as they can. And then we'll pay your bills for a year up to $5,000. And, you know, you never want to sign off for something like that unless you are absolutely certain that you're not going to have any longer term problems. And this is a great call because it demonstrates all too clearly what I see happen a lot. And that is, look, people, everybody's got this notion. Everybody, many people think people are out there with their hand out. It's not true at all. Wisconsin's a wonderful state with good people in it. People want to be better. They don't want to be injured. They don't want to have to keep going to the doctor. And so people often do what you do. They wait a little bit and then it seems better. And then you go back, and we're a state that has very distinct seasons, and you don't do the same things in winter that you do in spring and summer. And so it's all too easy to not ride your bike or not jog or not canoe or do what it is you do during the summer if you're hurt in October, and maybe you just don't do those things for a few weeks, and then it's winter and you don't. And now spring comes or summer comes and you start going back to regular activities and you realize you really do have a longer term problem. So first of all, they don't get to dictate what you do or don't do in terms of treatment. If you have health insurance, the treatment should always run through your health insurance anyway. You're far better off to do it that way than to ask them to pay for it. So run it through your health insurance, get the treatment you need, go back to the company once you've had that treatment, see if you recover fully or if you don't. And, you know, see if you want to try to negotiate with them directly, you're certainly welcome to do that. If you don't, then call a lawyer. There's certainly, you know, you see ads every day. I don't think they're the best way to choose a lawyer, but find a lawyer, talk to somebody you know, talk to a lawyer maybe that you know, and ask for a recommendation for somebody that can help you with an injury claim. And, you know, pursue the claim. I mean, you have a right to be compensated. It seems pretty clear that the problem you're having stems from this accident. And the notion that, and we get this all the time from companies, just because you didn't treat immediately does not mean you don't have a valid claim and a valid injury that's related to that accident.
There you go. David, good luck. Thank you so much for calling. Appreciate your call. Let's go to Jerry in Eagle River next. Then we'll get to Jane and then John. Jerry, what's on your mind?
Hey, good morning, Jerry. Thanks for taking my call. Real quick, I won't take up too much of your time. A few years back, I was in construction. I had a serious injury, got through it, could not work again. All my debt that I incurred during the time, I wanted to pay back, so I talked to an attorney. He got me into filing a Chapter 128, and that pays back all my debtors at the time of the time we have a court date. And it worked out good. It took me 3 years. I paid all my debtors back because I'm that kind of a guy, like the gentleman said. Wisconsin people do want to, you know, pay back everything. However, this has been 4 years since I paid them off, and I still have a credit rating that you couldn't get a drink of water at a gas station or get a credit card.
So, Kevin Trust, what about that?
Well, you mentioned Chapter 128, and that's how – really Wisconsin-specific alternative to bankruptcy. The rules aren't quite as regimented as they are under the federal rules. And in contrast to the federal rules, with the federal bankruptcy code, at the end of the bankruptcy process, you would get a discharge of your debt. With the Chapter 128, like the caller mentioned, he was, you know, he made the payments, paid off the debt over time, as a lot of good Wisconsin people are, you know, believe rightly that they should do. But however, you don't get a discharge of anything else that might be hanging out there at the end. And I think your question is specific to rebuilding your credit score following this whole process, because, you know, you had the debts and obviously they were getting past due and you were making payments on them, but nevertheless, they were still past due at the time. And so that's still going to be a negative drag on your credit rating. One way, I don't know if your situation is such that you can't get a credit card at this point in time because of the credit rating or not. But one thing I've seen people successfully do is work with a local bank or a national bank with what's called a secured credit card, which is where you put a bunch of money up front as kind of security, collateral for your credit card payments that you're going to charge against the card. And then you have that and you work against that when you're using the credit card. And, you know, while you might not have a really high credit limit and be able to buy everything under the sun that you may want to buy, on the other hand, it's a way of rebuilding your credit history, because it'll show up on your credit report, you know, as a trade line, and you'll see that if you keep making the regular payments on your secured credit card, that will help improve your credit rating over time.
Kevin, is there any possibility of going to the credit rating agencies and kind of explaining what happened? Because, I mean, this is obviously a very principled, upright gentleman. And you'd think, if anything, you'd get credit for being the kind of person that who could have just filed a bankruptcy and instead paid everything off. He seems like he's a pretty darn good risk to me.
That's true. He does seem like a pretty good risk to me, too. And you know, while you can go and talk with the credit reporting agencies, there's three of them. I don't know if that's going to have any real material effect. I think what will have a material effect over time is time itself. Because as you get farther and farther away from no longer being behind on your payments on your credit cards, your credit score will start to go up again, because you won't have those negative lack of payments dragging you down.
That makes sense. So what is that called again, the credit card that you were talking about? Go to your bank and
It's called a secured credit card. Basically, you pay a bunch of money up front as kind of collateral for them giving you the credit card, and then you could work against that. They'll still send you a monthly statement, and as long as you pay your monthly statement, you're going to start to rebuild your credit history.
One other thing is that I negotiate with medical care providers on a fairly regular basis, because we have clients who are injured, and even though we'll get a settlement, the bills, sometimes the insurance coverage isn't adequate out there to pay all the bills. And many medical care providers, particularly hospitals, are willing to negotiate. So if you're faced with a substantial amount of medical care debt, especially hospital debt, I would say it's certainly worth approaching them. A lot of them have programs that will enable them to write down debt or write off debt under certain circumstances. So while it does this gentleman great credit that he did what he did, I would certainly, before you undertake that, I'd at least make an effort to negotiate this down, hopefully.
Yeah. Yep, that makes a lot of sense. Jerry, thank you so much for calling. We'll turn to Jane in Blanchardville next. Hi, Jane.
Hello. My questions are regarding possibly doing a Chapter 12, which is for farm that we have. So my question is basically, how does Chapter 12 really work? If you're with the dairy prices and farms struggling that way, I mean, we got in a situation because we, it's been a hard time paying the bills, I guess, with the mortgage company and losing the farm. So can you explain that to me? And if by chance down the road in a divorce situation, how the repayment plan within the Chapter 12 would work?
Okay, well, let's go to Kevin for that.
Well, Jane, that's a pretty big question right there. But I can guarantee you that you're not the only one who's been suffering and wrangling with this type of issue. Over the last few years, we've seen a real uptick in the number of especially smaller dairy operations that are considering Chapter 12s, which is a bankruptcy chapter that's specific for the farm industry. And there's specific rules and regulations that govern that, that are unlike, a personal type of bankruptcy through Chapter 7 and through Chapter 13. I mean, honestly, I'd be hesitant to try and explain the intricacies of Chapter 12 over the air here. And I think it's something that if you're seriously considering and want to look at, it's something that you should probably talk with somebody in somebody's office, with an attorney who is experienced in dealing with Chapter 12s.
So it's a different kind of setup. You may or may not lose your land. You may or may not.
Really, it depends upon, the level of debt you have, what your debt is secured by, and what assets you have.
Yeah.
I think she asked about divorce, too, I think. And yeah. What happens if you have a bankruptcy and then you end up with a divorce?
Well, I think a Chapter 12 bankruptcy is a business-related bankruptcy. And so most likely, Jane has some type of business entity that technically runs the farm. And so that, if you're talking about Chapter 12, that would be a bankruptcy related to that business entity. On the other hand, if you're talking about a divorce and a bankruptcy associated with divorce, you're talking more on the personal side. So you're going to look at more of the, you're going to look at the Chapter 7 or Chapter 13 bankruptcy in that type of situation. And that's not uncommon either for somebody going through a divorce. And a lot of times, if a couple has had a lot of debts that have accumulated over the years, that's an added stress on the marriage or on the relationship and can be a contributing factor to people deciding to ultimately get divorced. And one way to get a fresh start is to either singly or jointly file for a bankruptcy in association with or at the same time as going through a divorce.
Okay. So, but you wouldn't be filing both a Chapter 12 and a Chapter 13, let's say, or you might.
You might.
You might file it. There might be a Chapter 12 filing, let's say, I don't know, first. Whatever,
for the business, sure.
For the business. And that could be followed by a Chapter 7 or 13. Seven.
Individually.
Individually.
If you have joint debts as a couple, it's leaving aside the Chapter 12 thing, if you've got joint debts, can one person file bankruptcy or would you have to file jointly?
Well, I don't think you have to file jointly, but what you'll have is you'll have a what's called a co-debtor stay for a lot of your joint debts, meaning if one of the two people files for bankruptcy, you'll have this bankruptcy stay that's put in place once you file, and that the stay basically is a prohibition that's placed on your creditors from attempting to collect from you personally while the bankruptcy action is going on. And if you file personally, that stay is going to kind of cross-apply over to the other spouse, the other partner who is liable on the debt as well.
Can one partner basically file and end up dumping the debt on the partner who is solvent or not?
That doesn't generally work.
I wasn't contemplating. I was just asking.
Okay. You can join in, too. Thanks, Jane, for calling. You can join in, too, at 1-800-642-1234 or email us at ideas@wpr.org. John in Appleton has a question for you, I think, to Mike. Hi, John.
Yeah, good morning, and thanks, everybody, for all you do. So our daughter owns her car. She's 22. She's going abroad where she won't need the car for about 8 months. Our plan is to store it in our garage. Does she or we need any insurance coverage on the vehicle for those 8 months? It's in her name totally. I did throw a question to DOT about getting our name as parents put on the title, but I haven't gotten a response.
I don't think you need insurance on the vehicle if it's in storage and no one's going to use it. And I stress no one's going to use it. The only thing you would probably need is comprehensive coverage. And even that is, I mean, the only thing that could happen likely is that the garage burns down or falls on the car. But other than that, it's hard to imagine. You can't have a collision if it's in the garage. And you certainly aren't going to be, there's no liability issues or medical payments issues. So I would go to the company and just talk to them. And often I've told people, if you have a specific company you work with, you can talk to them. Independent agents, to me, are often a really good source because they represent a bunch of different companies, which to me means they really represent you rather than the company. And that's not a shot at it. I mean, agents who write for AmFam or State Farm are good people, and, they can probably give you good advice. But the agent should be able to tell you exactly, whether there's any concerns there or not. But if assuming that the car is simply not going to be used, and I really mean not somebody deciding that just this one time I'll take it to the grocery store, because, of course, that's the time when something awful happens. But as long as it's sitting in the garage, the only thing would be comprehensive coverage. And, again, I think that's a stretch.
There you go. Although I do remember a fire where there were several vehicles Corvettes stored in that particular place. I think you'd want to have comprehensive under that.
Yeah, one of the worst moments of my life was I was working one summer breaking up basements while I was in college, and I would come home filthy, and the only solace was we had a boat at that time, and I'd take the boat out with my buddies, and we'd do whatever, but it was, you know, I'd get in the lake, and it just felt wonderful. Coming home one night, and there's this black pillar of smoke, and sure enough, one of my brothers is out fooling around in the garage, started a fire, and my boat burned up. So it isn't totally safe, even in the garage.
There you go. Thanks again for calling, John. Appreciate your call. Kate emailed to say she filed bankruptcy on her own in 2013. She didn't hire a lawyer. When she went to her discharge hearing, she was the only person there without a lawyer. She was able to find all the information she needed online and made one trip to the courthouse to file the paperwork. She sometimes feels that lawyers are there to hold a hand, and all the information was available directly to her. So she wonders, how can you afford a lawyer if you're filing for bankruptcy? There you go, Kevin.
Well, that can't be a challenge, can it? Because there's usually a reason people are filing for bankruptcy. And, well, congratulations to Kate. Apparently, her situation was such that it was a very straightforward bankruptcy, and none of her creditors raised an objection or tried to put any roadblocks in the way of her obtaining a discharge. And frankly, in that type of situation where, you know, it's plainly obvious the person isn't going to get a discharge under the bankruptcy statutes and code, that, you know, creditors aren't going to fight it or not going to raise any issues. However, not every situation is like Kate's.
Yeah.
There can be tricky situations where people have different kinds of debts that may or may not be dischargeable, and they may not be entitled to relief under the bankruptcy code for various types of debts like taxes or alimony or child support, those type of things. As far as paying for your bankruptcy lawyer, I think from my experience in dealing with, see, I generally deal with the other side, representing mm-hmm. the banks or the financial yeah. institutions. But from my experience, I've seen a lot of people and attorneys who file on behalf of debtors. They'll have payment plans or come up with some type of reasonable arrangement for payment.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that makes sense as well. Well, let's go back to the phones. Mary Jane in Madison has something for us. Mary Jane, thank you for calling.
Thank you for taking my call. I appreciate it. Can you hear me?
Yes.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Here's the situation. I had a friend that filed for bankruptcy and had everything sort of discharged many years ago, except that she was still paying on her mortgage and she had a home equity loan. And her home equity loan, of course, was secured by her condo. And she's been paying on that particular loan, like maybe $100 a month, trying to get rid of this loan for years now. And the bank that was servicing the loan, the bank that had the loan, sent it off to a service agency. And we have been trying to find out how much she owes on this loan. And no one can tell us anything about what's due. She does get a statement from the bank. I think the last one she got was at the beginning of, 2018 for 2017, showing this is how much it was and this is how much interest went on it. But we can't find out anything about this because, the problem was is it wasn't discharged. Well, in bankruptcy, because it was secured by the home, how can we get this off her record and get her condo, get it released from her condo? It's attached to her condo as security.
Well, Mary Jane, my understanding is this a friend or somebody that you know that this happened to?
Yeah, I was working with her on the bankruptcy at the time. But, yeah, it's my friend. And she had a lawyer, and they went through, I think, everything else was discharged, except that this home equity loan, I mean, you can discharge it, but it's my understanding that then the financial institution can then sue you and try to, because it was secured by the condo or by her home, that they could sue you and force you to sell the condo to pay this off because it was a secured loan.
Well, Mary Jane, I think what most likely happened in your friend's situation is that she reaffirmed the debt during the course of the bankruptcy proceedings. You know, she took a look and at the outset of the bankruptcy and decided, you know, I'd really like to keep my condo. I'd really like to keep my home. And in order to do that, I'd signed this reaffirmation agreement with my primary mortgage holder as well as the home equity mortgage holder, saying I will agree to continue to make the payments on this debt in spite of me filing for bankruptcy. Basically, I'll remove these items from the bankruptcy process and continue to make payments on them. And that's how, you know, she's still in the condo. That's how she's continuing to still make payments, because if it was a situation where it was a normal debt and she went through bankruptcy and it was something that was discharged, then I think you'd see that lender really back off and not be trying to collect and take payments on that debt.
I think the other question she had is, what can you do? I mean, I would assume that the bank that had the loan to begin with, I mean, if this other institution isn't responding, I'd go to the bank and say, look, I took this loan out with you. I'm simply trying to get information to enable me to pay it off. I want you guys, you know who's got this. You go and get me the information. And I would think, too, you might consider, if they can't get cooperation from them or from the loan service organization, I mean, I'd go to the Department of Financial Institutions and file a complaint, because they certainly owe her that information, don't they?
Yeah, and that situation with your friend Mary Jane is not unique at all. A lot of times this especially happened during the Great Recession, when you saw banks failing and the FDIC stepping in and transferring the assets of, you know, one bank to another bank, and the other banks trying to pick things up, you know, midstream and trying to deal with a whole slew of additional accounts it needs to deal with now. But it could be quite challenging to find a decision maker, you know, either with the servicing company or with the original bank, who can give you advice or tell you something definitive about what amount you need to pay, or if you need to try and make an adjustment to the amount that you need to pay. It can be challenging to find the person with that kind of authority. It takes a bit of digging. It's going to take a number of hours of time calling and kind of being a fly in their ear in order to
get it done.
But
if you go to the bank, I would think I'd try that. I'd go to the bank and say, hey, come on.
You're the people who I took out the loan with. And if these people who you gave it to are assigned responsibility for collecting it aren't being responsive, then you go track it down and get me the information. If it's a reputable bank, they should be willing to do that. And again, I don't know. I'm not sure how responsive they are, but I do think that it would be worth, if they're not doing that, going to the Department of Financial Institutions and file complaints. Businesses don't like that. They really don't. So that may produce some results.
Mary Jane, thank you so much for calling. Taking a look at some legal issues, we've zeroed in a bit on bankruptcy, but taking other questions as well with our two attorneys, Mike Riley and Kevin Trost, from the Axley Law Firm of Madison. I'm Larry Mueller here on the Ideas Network. Great to have you with us here on the Ideas Network. Larry Mueller here talking with our two attorneys today, Mike Riley and Kevin Trost from the Axley Law Firm of Madison, dealing with bankruptcy, among other things, insurance and other legal issues. Our lines are all filled. The number is 800-642-1234. Email us at ideas@wpr.org. Let's turn to John in Green Bay next. John, thanks for waiting.
Hello, thanks for the call. I just want to say that there is light at the end of the tunnel, having gone down that route myself for the Chapter 13. It was 2008-2009. I had owned a business for 30 years and lost it. So I do have a business background. I worked hard, you know, after the bankruptcy. It was strategic. There's also a divorce involved. So after the divorce was settled, then I negotiated with my ex, and I absorbed and paid off every debt that had her name on it, and then I took the hit myself. So there's our ways to do it properly. I'm 8 years into it. I got two more years in October 10th. Not that I'm counting, but that will be 10 years in 2010. But my credit rating And I have not really returned to the workforce. I became a caregiver for my parents, that sort of thing. There's a lot of changes took place, so I have a minimal income, let's just put it that way. But my credit rating now between the three of them averages about 770.
Wow.
And the only blemish on it, which I will be trying to rectify, is I did go back to school, and there were some student loans, but the loans were actually, you know, not due. So they're slamming me a little bit on the amortization schedule of the loans. However, while in school, the loans weren't due, and now I've accelerated those payments. So there is light at the end of the tunnel. I believe I have attorneys, but my total legal cost for the entire thing was $1,600, which I felt was fairly reasonable. And it wasn't quite as easy, but, you know, when you're dealing with credit card people and that, I always would have gamed it. I would always say, just remember, I'm not working and you are, and if I was working, you might not have a job. I always disarmed them with that. But then, as you guys know, the business stuff and that, those all involve attorneys, and basically it was the getting sued by everybody that really was the straw that broke the camel's back. So there is a road back. You're absolutely right. I mean, I hooked up my name with some family members and that, so I got credit cards in their names, and obviously those were paid. I did all the stuff that I could find to work it back. It has been 8 years, but there is a lot of that. So I have $23,000 in unsecured credit right now, and zero balance is due on any account. So
there you go.
That's great. And, you know, a couple points I think, and Kevin should comment too. But one, you know, I know somebody talked about, is it worth hiring a lawyer? And, you know, first of all, you can go and talk to a lawyer. I know the woman who called about the Chapter 12. I mean, most lawyers will at least give you some time and talk to you about whether or not you really need a lawyer, or whether this is something they can help with and not charge you, maybe charge you nothing, certainly not charge you a lot of money to do that. And my impression, I know big corporate bankruptcies and maybe a very involved personal bankruptcy would certainly be more expensive. But my impression, Kevin, is that the fees for like a personal bankruptcy are not all that high generally.
That's true. And I think the amount that John was mentioning in his call is what I've seen people get charged for in the past as well. So you're not talking a horribly exorbitant amount.
Yeah.
So yeah, congratulations to John. Talk about a class act.
Congratulations, John. It's really nice to hear that, you know, hear a success story, because, you know, at the end of the day, the bankruptcy code was meant and intended for people to be able to have a fresh start after they, you know, for one reason or another, got in way too far over their head.
Thanks, John. Appreciate the call. Linda in Williams Bay, your turn.
Good morning, gentlemen.
Hi.
Hi.
What's on your mind today?
Well, I have a comment in regards to the gentleman who called with the 128, Chapter 128, and his credit score being so low.
Yeah.
What he could do is he could call the actual collection agencies and ask them if they will remove those debts from the three credit bureaus. I work at a collection agency, and we actually do that for consumers. You know, we feel that once a debt is paid, why should the consumer continue to have their credit rating ruined?
And you've had success doing that.
Oh, yeah, we do it.
Do you know that when you do that, are you convinced? I understand they maybe take the debt away. Do they take the impact away, too? Does that then go away and it's as if the debt hadn't been there to begin with?
Slowly, his credit rating would come back up.
Okay.
And also, if collection agency wouldn't remove it, he could call the original creditor who sent the debt to the collection agency. We've had that scenario as well. So sometimes it takes a little more effort, but some agencies are quite willing to do that these days.
You know, while we've got you on the phone, as we're getting advice, which sounds like great advice, you know, I know that we deal with credit, we deal with collection agencies fairly regularly on the behalf of clients. Again, my clients are people who've been injured. You know, and I know that, you know, there's no set rule, and I'm sure it varies depending on who the creditor is. But my impression has been that a lot of creditors would certainly rather have half a loaf than none, or, you know, three quarters of a loaf or whatever it might be. And I think that, often people, you know, don't take the opportunity to at least make some effort to negotiate when, you know, they might be able to do that successfully.
Negotiate with the original creditor?
Well, negotiate. I mean, that generally we do it through the agency, and the agency goes back to the creditor, because obviously the agency can't simply say, okay, fine, we'll take that. But my experience has been when the agency does go back to the creditor, not always certainly, but it's not uncommon that we can get a reduction in the debt if there's a reasonable basis to request for that.
Very true.
Yeah. All right.
That's very true.
Thank you.
Linda, thank you very much for calling. Appreciate your call. Good calls here today, all of them. Let's go to Stacy in Madison next. Hi, Stacy.
Hi, good afternoon. My biggest question is with Chapter 7 and 13, my husband and I ran into, about 4 years that we had multiple surgeries and hospital stays that put us quite a bit in debt, and we had family and friends suggest that we go through, you know, some sort of Chapter 7 or Chapter 13. The problem that we're running into is we've got quite a bit of asset. We have my husband has a family cabin that his name is on that has a loan against it. We have duplexes, one that we live in and another one, but they both have loans also. And then we have, you know, land, campers, things like that that we still owe money on. But I also have children who are over the age of 18. Is that possible to transfer, like, these houses or the land to them? And if so, how long would we have to wait before
that would take effect? Yeah, understood. Kevin, what's the rule on that?
Yeah, and that's something people do take advantage of. They do transfer assets to relatives or friends. There's a certain look-back period because, obviously, if you're just willy-nilly transferring assets to your children or to others and then file bankruptcy, that's going to raise a lot of red flags with the bankruptcy trustee as well as with the creditors. Have you talked with a bankruptcy attorney about this process yet?
No, we actually haven't because, you know, we're able to pay everything. You know, we're living, kind of getting caught up on everything else. It's just our medical bills that now all of a sudden we're getting judgment against us and calls, and, you know, we're not quite sure where to go at this point.
Yeah.
Yeah.
You know, let me just chime in quickly. I mean, the first thing I would do, especially with medical debt, is see if you can't negotiate. I mean, I would explain, I'd go to the people and say, look, my alternative is bankruptcy. We just can't continue to juggle all these balls. And the only way we can make this work is if everyone agrees to take a significant reduction. Because my impression is, and you heard the lady who actually works for a credit agency, or I'm sorry, for a collection agency, say that, you know, they can go back to the people who have sent the debts to them, and they will often accept a fairly significant reduction. And again, medical facilities, particularly hospitals, often have a specific program for people who simply can't afford to take care of all this that will let them write that down or even write it off under certain circumstances. So I would at least explore that possibility before you consider, you know, bankruptcy as an alternative. And then Kevin can talk about how long are the clawbacks? Do they vary? I know they call them clawbacks if yes, they're going to try to get assets that you've transferred. How does that work?
No, it can vary, and that's why I think you want to talk with a bankruptcy attorney about your specific situation, because you certainly don't want to take all those efforts to transfer assets to relatives or your kids, and then, you know, and then still be in trouble if you go and file bankruptcy and have the bankruptcy trustee and have your creditors raising issues and problems. But it sounds like it's a situation that has gotten to the situation now where you definitely need to take some action if, as you say, the hospitals are getting money judgments against you in court now. And like Mike said, I think first first step is to try and talk with the hospitals themselves to see if you can work out some type of deal through them. And if not, then I would consult a bankruptcy attorney.
You know, maybe after the break, we can talk a little bit about exemptions, because she was talking about, and I know that there's a lot involved there, but it is, maybe we can talk in general terms what people can exempt from a bankruptcy.
That makes a lot of sense. And the number of years is going to vary. I mean, if you donate or you title over to your kids your house or something, it might be, what, 5 years before you could essentially have that not be a problem?
That is true. There's a certain amount of time. The other thing that'll come into play is whether the asset's being transferred for fair value. If your kids are paying for it and they're giving you a fair value for whatever you're transferring to them, that's a completely different story than if you're just willy-nilly
and you're still making the payments if you have mortgages and so forth. Okay. Well, we can talk a bit more about exemptions, and certainly we have lots of questions on Keith, and Chris and Karen are waiting online to talk as well. Our two guests today, Michael Riley and Kevin Trost, they are both attorneys with the law firm of Axley, the Axley Law Firm of Madison. I'm Larry Mueller, and we'll be back right after we take a look at the news, weather, and find out what else is in store for us. Stay with us. Great to have you along today on the Ideas Network. Larry Mueller here as we take a look at all kinds of legal issues. We've zeroed in a bit on bankruptcy, but taken other questions as well from our two attorneys with us today, Mike Riley and Kevin Trost, both with the Axley Law Firm and of Madison. Always great to have them come by and talk with you, and certainly appreciate you listening in. Questions for them, give a call. 800-642-1234. Email us at ideas@wpr.org. And just to go back to, before we go back to the phones, we had Keith and Chris and Karen. We were talking about exemptions a little bit. Kevin, you want to expand on that a bit?
Sure. And, you know, by exemptions, what we're talking about is money or assets that you're able to shield from your creditors, keep it to yourself through the bankruptcy process. And the bankruptcy code sets forth, you know, a certain amount of money or value that you can protect from your creditors during the bankruptcy process in various categories. And obviously the biggest one is that people are most interested in is their home. Are they going to be able to keep their home? And in Wisconsin, your homestead, you as an individual, you can protect up to $75,000 of the value of your home. And if you're filing jointly with your spouse or significant other, you can protect another $75,000 of that asset. And obviously, there's other exemptions for motor vehicles, and there's even what's called under the federal bankruptcy code a wild card exemption, which is a certain amount of money that you can kind of apply to various categories if you're a little short in terms of being able to protect assets. But the other thing to always keep in mind is that your retirement assets, things you have in your 401k or money that you have in an IRA, is shielded. That's nothing that your creditors can go and reach in and grab money from.
Okay, there we go. Good to know. Keith in Woodboro, your turn now. Hi, Keith.
Hi, Larry. My question has to do with a judgment that was filed against me.
Okay.
And I mean, to start from the beginning, I did a voluntary surrender back in the 1990s.
Okay.
For a vehicle, and in 2008, they filed a judgment against me. The judgment expired in 2010, and now I was trying to refinance my home for a lower rate, and the title company says that they won't do anything until I get this judgment released. They said I had to talk to the law firm that was involved, and it's a law firm out of Milwaukee. Don't ask me to pronounce the guy's name because I'll wreck it for sure. But that man told me, he says, there's nothing I have to do. He says, your title company is misinterpreting some wording. So I called the title company back, and they said, no, we're not. And I said, well, this is from an attorney. I think he knows what he's talking about. And so the attorney says, well, have them call me. So they called. Apparently they call him, but I'm still not getting any satisfaction. What can I do on my part to try and get this rectified?
Well, first thing I'd do is call the attorney's office, and, you know, he can draft a satisfaction of judgment. They're standard forms. I mean, it'd take him 2 minutes to do that, and I'm assuming that's the right form. Kevin would know more than I would. But, I mean, there is a form that he could file that would take care of it, and why not just do that? Tell him you'll be happy to come down and pick it up and file it yourself if he'd just prepare it.
Absolutely. And the other alternative, if you can't get any traction that way, is if the judgment is truly expired, something that can't be collected on anymore, there's a specific state statute that you can ask the court in which the judgment was entered in. You can ask the court to expunge the judgment.
Oh, okay. So that's probably something you'd want an attorney.
I think you might want an attorney to pursue that. But I think if you take Mike's approach first, I think that'd be the best first step.
Yeah, just, you know, it sounds like you've done the right thing. I mean, I'd be nice. I wouldn't yell at him, but I'd just say, boy, I'd really appreciate it if you could do this. This is just causing a real problem for me. And like I said, it would take him literally about 30 seconds to dictate something and have it typed up.
And what would you call it again?
Well, it should be a satisfaction, a judgment, or release a judgment.
Either a satisfaction or a release.
Okay.
I think in the end, the title company wants some type of piece of paper that they can hold in their hand and say, aha, now I have a reason why I can take this line off of the title report.
Okay. All right. That makes sense. Keith, good luck with that. Thank you so much for calling. Appreciate your call. And Chris in Madison, your turn. Hi, Chris.
Hi. I just have a comment. Earlier in your show, you were saying something about flood insurance, okay?
Yes.
And the street I live on, typically in a heavy rain, floods. And that, you know, the rain we had like a couple weeks ago, it flooded to within like 6 feet of coming into our garage, okay? Then it went down. It didn't come in. And this has happened periodically as long as I've lived here over the past 30 years. But so when we first moved into the house and the street would flood, I thought, oh, okay, I need flood insurance. Well, back then, I couldn't get it because I didn't live on a floodplain. So just out of curiosity, my husband checked with our insurance to see if we could get flood insurance now. And apparently, I don't know what's changed, but yes, they said we could get flood insurance. However, the premium for this flood insurance is about $1,500 a year.
Yeah, a little over $100 a month.
Yeah. So, and our house, I'm sure it's based on the value of our house, which is just a little over $200,000. So I don't know if, you know, people with more expensive houses, of course, would have to pay more. So, you know, when you think about, say you have $10,000 worth of damage from a flood, how many years it would take to pay those premiums, just something to think about, that it's just like, oh, it's not this inexpensive little rider that you put on your homeowner's insurance. It's a pretty fair piece of change.
Yeah.
Yeah, I'm interested. Who was going to give you the insurance? Was it your own insurer, or were they going through, there's a federal flood insurance program?
I think they had to go through somebody. I'm not sure my husband took care of it. I know we got an email or something in the mail a week or so ago, but that was the premium.
Yeah, I don't think, and I this is not something where I have a lot of expertise, but I don't believe, first of all, all homeowners policies that I've ever seen exclude flood coverage. So there's always an exclusion in your standard homeowners. And you're right that if you're going to get it, you'd have to go out and buy it separately or in addition. And again, I think talking to an independent agent, is a really good idea in those situations, because they obviously have a variety of companies. But my guess is they're going to tell you the same thing, that those companies don't write flood insurance as part of your homeowners. You're going to have to go, whether it's a federal program or whether there's a specialty insurer that handles that. And boy, you're right, that's a lot of money. Unless you really think the risk is a major risk, it would be hard to justify that kind of premium. I mean, that's likely more than you're paying to insure your home, period.
That's right. Well, thanks a lot, Chris, for calling. I appreciate your call very much. By the way, you can join in if you have a question or comment, 1-800-642-1234. Karen in Green Bay, it's your turn. Hi, Karen.
Hi.
What can we do for you?
I was calling because I wanted to get information regarding filing a Chapter 13 in order to save our house from going into foreclosure.
Okay. Karen, have you talked with your mortgage holder?
Yes, we tried to do a remodification and they denied us, saying that we didn't have enough money in the end. I'm not really sure how to explain that because they didn't really explain it to us. My partner lost her job back in December, got a new job in the same industry. We had to show proof of pay for 30 days, which we did. Including what I get from my disability, and they still declined us. They said she either has to get a second job or we'd have to get income somehow. So we did that. We've been talking to them. We wanted to try and reapply because obviously she's doing extra work, but they're still being very of a matter of fact. They don't want to remodify it. So our next step was talk to an attorney, but we're not even sure that's going to be the right choice.
Well, let me just, I mean, for one thing, have you talked to other lenders? Have you gone to other lending institutions to see if someone else would be willing, you know, to extend the loan, to give you a loan, effectively buy out, you know, your current mortgage holder? If you haven't done that, I'd at least give that a try. You know, it's interesting whether it's insurance or banking or everything else. You know, those of us who are on the outside kind of assume it's this monolith and everybody does things the same way. And it's really not. I mean, everybody has somewhat different standards. It's certainly true with insurance. I think it's true with banking as well, that some are just more willing to look at things a particular way and to say, okay, these people are actually a good risk. So I would at least try that. And then Kevin can address the bankruptcy part.
Sure. And I think you had mentioned being interested in a Chapter 13. Is there a reason why you were interested in a Chapter 13 as opposed to a 7?
Well, because we want to keep the home.
Well, sure. I mean, I think you'd still be able to, there's a potential that you could still keep the home with a Chapter 7. I don't know what the value of your home is or what your other assets are, but there's a possibility of keeping the home under either chapter of the bankruptcy code. I think what you want to, sounds like a situation where you definitely want to talk with somebody in this field in your area who could help you evaluate whether it makes sense or not to pursue bankruptcy, or maybe that person could give you some additional insight into how to best reapproach your current mortgage holder to see and get some explanation for why they would not modify your loan.
Yeah. And then looking at other potential lenders, as Mike was talking about, it certainly sounds like a good idea as well.
I think it's worthwhile to at least try it.
Yeah. So there you go, Karen. Thank you so much. We have open lines. Get you on pretty quickly at 1-800-642-1234. Maxine in the UP called to ask if debt consolidation is a scam or is a legitimate option to bankruptcy.
Well, you see that every once in a while, and you see a lot of ads for people and companies, especially out-of-state companies for some reason, that want to consolidate your debt into one easy monthly payment. And basically, isn't an alternative to bankruptcy? Well, yeah, in a way, but it's really not. It's not bankruptcy. It's basically trying to combine all of your debts, all your payments into one. And my understanding is that, you know, the debt consolidation company will attempt to negotiate with your creditors to get a, you know, smaller payment than what you'd be paying now. But there's no guarantee that they would be able to do that. And so on top of making the, you know, the monthly payment to your creditors on your behalf, they will also charge you some token or nominal or maybe less than nominal fee for their services.
Okay, so
So I want to know, are the credit card companies really tricking me? Can I pay much less the way I hear in the ads every day?
not in my experience.
There you go, Maxine. Thank you. Jim called to ask if employers can discriminate against employees who have filed for bankruptcy, and also how many people actually file for bankruptcy.
Well, last part of the question first. Less people file for bankruptcy now than you were seeing, you know, several years ago, during the Great Recession, during 2008 up through maybe 2011, 12, 13, you were seeing very high numbers of people filing bankruptcy. And I think since that time, over the last 5 years, you've seen a gradual decrease in the number of people filing to, you know, kind of what is the normal level during regular economic times for people filing bankruptcy.
Terms of employers, can an employer sort of discriminate against an employee because that person, he or she, has filed for bankruptcy?
Yeah, well, it's kind of a general question, and it really depends. As a general proposition, an employer should not discriminate on because somebody's filed for bankruptcy. However, there are certain situations where it might be a condition of their employment that they have their credit history be clean and not be in a situation where they have filed bankruptcy or are in financial trouble. You can see that in a condition of employment oftentimes for somebody in the financial industry, if you work for a bank or even if you work for a debt collection company.
Mm-hmm.
That might be a condition of employment.
That could be a condition of employment. I think there was another one. Dave, is there another question online that I wanted to... I thought there was one more online before we take any other calls. I guess not. I think we've covered them all. Let's go back to the phones then and to Mary in Sauk County. Hi, Mary.
Hi, Larry. Thank you. I have a real difficult situation, and I hope the attorneys have a suggestion or two. Is there a way to fight a false positive drug test? I have been accused of taking a drug that I did not take, and I'm getting my pain medication cut off as a result, which I've been on for 22 years.
Well, the first thing, do they still have the sample? Can they retest? Can you request that they retest the sample?
I don't know if they still have the sample. I immediately, as soon as they accused me of failing the test, I said, I'll take another test right now, and they wouldn't let me do that. I don't know if they still have the sample.
Well, I mean, that's the first thing I'd do is I'd go back to them and one or two things. See, either retest the sample or send it to a different lab to test because, you know, if this lab, there's always a possibility that the lab made a mistake. And, you know, you have every right. That's a very serious consequence, and they ought to be willing to do that. Who's refusing you the drug? Is this your doctor or the
insurance agent?
Yes, this is my doctor, and I have never abused this medication in the 22 years I've been taking it.
Have you talked to the doctor specifically? I mean, is the doctor the one that issued this edict, or is this just coming out of the healthcare facility as sort of a matter of course?
I talked to the doctor's nurse, and I begged and said, I'll be glad to take another test, and was not able to talk to the doctor directly, but the nurse got back to me and said, the doctor doesn't feel comfortable prescribing this anymore, and naturally this will be in my medical records or any other doctor in the state, or maybe the nation, to see.
I'd go to patient relations. I mean, I'd go to patient relations for the clinic or facility, whatever it is, and I'd tell them that you're absolutely convinced this is a false positive, you've never abused this, that you want them to retest that sample, and if they don't have it, then they should run another test and just explain that, you know, they're compromising your health, in effect, or creating a real risk to your health based on a false positive, and it's their obligation to make sure that this is accurate. And, you know, if they didn't keep the sample, which they certainly should have, I mean, if this sample was going to lead them to take that kind of draconian action, then they should have kept the sample. But I'd go to patient relations and work through them. It may be, all doctors are different, just like lawyers are different. Maybe this guy is just not comfortable doing things, and maybe somebody else within the facility, maybe the director of medicine for the facility or someone else would be willing to take a look. But I think you should go to patient relations and try tell them you need to get this worked out.
Yeah, absolutely. Good luck. And Mary, thank you so much for calling. Another Mary, well, this one from Wauwatosa. Have you got a quick question for us?
Yeah. Thank you for taking my call. I live in Wauwatosa, and we've been getting requests from insurance companies to purchase insurance to insure the water line and the sewage line to the street. We're responsible for those. I can't get a straight answer, though, in terms of if the city wants to replace the laterals, if they would replace them, or if there would have to be some damage to both lines if they would replace them. I was wondering if you knew anything about this insurance.
I know a very little bit that I can tell you. What I can tell you is we're getting the same thing in Madison. It's coming from the city, and the city is suggesting that we should take out this insurance because if they have to replace the laterals, then it would cost X dollars, and obviously it's a fair amount of money. They cover everything in the street the city has to cover. So the things that are actually running under the street that your laterals are feeding into, the city would take care of. But the laterals that come from your house to the street apparently aren't covered. I had no idea that was the case till I got my little notice from the city of Madison.
Yeah.
So, you know, your question was, I don't think they're just going to willy-nilly replace them. I think at some point, obviously, most things end up needing replacement. I think all they're saying is that, you know, I buy this insurance and then they'll take care of that. I have no idea. Is it a good idea, bad idea? I guess you could ask the city if the city can give you an estimate of what it would cost to replace the lateral, because that would at least give you some information so you could say, okay, you know, I'm weighing this premium against that potential cost.
Yeah.
I talked to somebody in the city and see, one, are they planning to do this? How likely is it they need to do this in the next 10 years, say? And secondly, how much would it cost?
Yeah, I think the cost, for Madison at least, was minimal.
The insurance cost.
Yeah, the insurance cost was like $25 or something.
It wasn't a lot, Larry, I agree.
Yeah, it was not. And on that note, we are out of time. Mike and Kevin, I want to thank you so much for being with us today. I really appreciate it. I hope we can do this again.
Oh, it's always a pleasure, Larry. Hope we'll see you again soon.
Thank you for having us.
Mike Riley, third-generation Madison attorney for the Axley Law Firm, senior partner, and Kevin Trost as well, attorney, specializes in creditors' rights, workouts, receiverships, lots of things going on in the bankruptcy area. Also a partner in the Axley Law Firm of Madison. Well, tomorrow we'll be talking about Professor Art Hassler and his legacy in the limnology department at UW-Madison, and then look at what's going on with the Aldo Leopold Society. In the meantime, thank you for listening. Please stay with us. Lots in store on the Ideas Network.